You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to PTCE's Pharmacy Connect, a podcast focused on continuing education created by pharmacists for pharmacists. PTCE is the leader in pharmacy and managed care education. In these episodes, listeners will be presented with the most recent clinical updates and strategies for implementing into practice.
Today, we will discuss strategies about implementing digital technology tools within health systems for improving adherence and patient support.
Here's our host and founder of the Pharmacy Podcast Network, Todd Urey.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation, this is Todd Urey with the Pharmacy Podcast. Excited about today. This is a second part, a follow-up to a previous conversation that we have. We are on a very important topic. Today, we're going to talk about implementing digital technology tools with health systems for improving adherence and patient support. And we're highlighting BTK inhibitors in patient management. And we're having our special guest return to really highlight this and kind of dig into this. This is interesting for me. I love technology. I love the fact that pharmacists are engaging digital therapeutics and technology to do more for their patients. Welcome back, Dr. Anthony Parasinati. I hope you've been doing well.
Thanks for having me back, Todd. I had a great time the first time, and I'm sure we'll have a great time again.
Absolutely. Just in case the listeners don't know, Dr. Anthony, give just a short background as a clinical pharmacist and specialist in what you focus on.
Sure. So I'm a clinical pharmacist specialist in hematology. So I take care of patients with aggressive lymphomas, indolent lymphomas, and acute leukemias. I typically see patients when they're on the inpatient side, when they're a little bit more acutely ill. And I also help with my colleagues when our patients are transitioned to the outpatient. There's a lot of back and forth with some of these patients. Fortunately, with these indolent lymphomas, most of them can be managed completely as an outpatient. So I get to take care of them in a variety of different settings.
So in our previous episode, you and I touched on BTK inhibitors, and you shared with us before about their usages, and you really did a really great job and kind of the differences, and we started kind of splitting hairs. And for listeners, there's going to be part one in the show notes. If you haven't listened to part one, there will be a link there. But can you kind of give us the uses, the difference in B cell malignancies? Can you remind us of which agents there are and where they're used?
Yeah, I would love to. And you know, the way you described it, splitting hairs, that's exactly what we did last time. All three of these agents that we use are all very efficacious. They are safe medications. And really, it comes down to my type A personality to really distinguish the differences between these. But for most patients, you know, they're not going to notice any differences between the three agents. So the first BTK inhibitor is what we call our first generation. It came to market first, is ibrutinib. And so with ibrutinib, there were some off-target toxicities because ibrutinib doesn't just inhibit BTK. None of the BTK inhibitors just inhibit BTK. And so the claim to fame for our second generations was, let's make them a little bit more specific to BTK so that we can prevent some of the off-target toxicities. And so our second generations are acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. And, you know, as I suggested, there's not really much difference from an efficacy standpoint, at least from what we've studied thus far. But there seems to be more and more hints that there are differences in tolerability, where acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib may be a little bit more tolerated for some patients. Now, because ibrutinib has been on the market the longest, it's been FDA approved and NCCN recommended in a number of settings. The first is first line CLL, and you know, really all lines of CLL. We'll also use it in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, mantle cell lymphoma in the second line setting or later, and then marginal zone lymphoma in the second line or later. With acalabrutinib, it came a little bit later than ibrutinib. It's starting to move into all spaces, but for right now, where it's FDA approved is frontline CLL, and we'll use it also later lines. And then also, similar to ibrutinib, it's used in mantle cell lymphoma in the second line. Now, zanubrutinib is the newest kid on the block. Right now, its FDA approval is in mantle cell lymphoma in the second line. And I do anticipate later this year that it will likely get an FDA approval for Waldenstrom macroglobulinemia. And that's based off of a randomized controlled trial comparing zanubrutinib to ibrutinib in Waldenstrom's. So those are the agents, and those are where we use them.
You know, when I talk to different pharmacists about disease states and the special intensity that they bring to their patients from the information that you soak in, that you understand as clinical pharmacists. I think of the health system pharmacist and the unique environment that they're in, where they have a shortened amount of time with their patients and they see cases that are different over and over again. And I'm curious to understand, what are some of the challenges pharmacists have with management of these agents within the health system pharmacy setting?
Now, globally, the biggest challenge for pharmacists is constantly having to adapt, right? So we went from using primarily cytotoxic chemotherapies, which have their own challenges, to now completely, you know, resurfacing how we treat these patients with BTK inhibitors and other oral targeted therapies. And so that was a huge paradigm shift. So we had to change the way that we manage patients, change the way that we look at patients, change what we monitor for patients. So there's a lot of change. So I think the biggest challenge for pharmacists is just constantly adapting to change, being sort of like the chameleon of the team, that whatever is needed from a patient perspective, we jump in and we help our patient in that way. You know, from a specific perspective of our oral BTK inhibitors, you know, one of the bigger challenges is that these are oral agents. They're no longer IV medications. And so when you're given an intravenous medication, it has to be administered by a nurse. The patients come in every, you know, 3-4 weeks or so. But a nurse can physically watch the patient get the medication, right? Well, with BTK inhibitors, patients are on therapy potentially lifelong or until they progress, which could be years. And so they're taking a medication once, maybe twice per day, indefinitely. And we're not there with our patients in their home watching them take their medication. We do our best to remind them, but adherence can be a big challenge for patients. So we end up having to rely a lot on our patients. So one of the things that we'll do is talk about the importance of adherence up front, which we're going to talk extensively about today, and also to remind them to call us when they're having problems and when they have questions. So adherence was one of the big challenges. Monitoring patients is a little bit different as well. Normally, you know, with monitoring of cytotoxic chemotherapy, things usually monitoring for the first couple of days for things like tumor lysis syndrome. Then you might get, you know, interim labs, but usually our PAs and MDs are monitoring to see if their counts are dropping. Well, with our BTK inhibitors, there's not really cycles. This is just continuous therapy that we have to continue to kind of be in touch with our patients. So over time, patients develop toxicities, and it's not always easy to catch because they're at home and we might not be in close communication with them. Even if we are communicating with them initially, you know, every 2 weeks or, you know, more often than that, sometimes eventually they're on therapy for years and we can't keep kind of holding their hand through therapy. And it could be 6 months before, you know, the last time that we talked to the patient. And then coordination with oral medications is a challenge. You know, you would think that writing a prescription is easy as writing a prescription, patient goes to the pharmacy and picks it up, right? That's what I do when I have a medication, just go to CVS and great, my medication's waiting for me. Unfortunately, with oral chemotherapies, because of their expense, because of restrictions of where they need to go through specialty pharmacies, it ends up going through a lot of different hands that us as pharmacists, we kind of have to track. It can go through insurance companies and stall through there. There could be some issues with copays that are financial coordinators or working through. Things can then go back to the clinic where we're waiting for physicians to kind of write appeal letters. Sometimes we're waiting for specialty pharmacy, waiting for delivery. So, you know, if we're not on the ball with our oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors, there can be significant delays for some patients.
So take us through, walk our pharmacists through who are listening through different touch points pharmacists have within the patient journey as they start a BTK inhibitor.
Every institution is a little bit different, but I can give you a broad example of how our pharmacists interact. And there are multiple pharmacists. It's not just me, or it's just not my colleague. We have multiple pharmacists in multiple different settings with multiple different backgrounds. So the first place that our pharmacists are embedded are within our clinics, whether it's a lymphoma clinic or a leukemia clinic. They are physically there with the healthcare team, making decisions, educating the patient right then and there. The next touch point is the actual pharmacy. So when we send off medications to the pharmacy, we have another pharmacist that's dispensing the medication and educating patients. When the patient goes home, there are pharmacists that will monitor them and contact them from home. We have an oral chemotherapy program, which is a different pharmacist than I am, has different training than I do, and they are following up with their patient. And then the patient also has options of which pharmacist they want to contact depending on what issue they have. Sometimes they'll send us text messages through our EMR, which we call M-baskets. They can communicate when they have specific issues, or they can communicate to, you know, our pharmacy who's dispensing, or they can communicate to our oral chemo pharmacist. You know, one point I want to make is sometimes when we prescribe these medications and we're following them very closely for the first couple of weeks, the months, eventually patients need to be managed closer to home, and they're not seeing us very often. And so they have an established PCP or a cardiologist. And so when some of the toxicities that we talked about on our last podcast, like atrial fibrillation or bleeds or hypertension, and there are some other toxicities like diarrhea, myalgias, rashes that can happen with our BTK inhibitors, some of these toxicities are happening and the patient's closer to home. It could be, you know, 100 miles away. And so we don't necessarily always know that they're having the toxicities because they'll present to their PCP or their cardiologist or their local hospital. Well, then there's another pharmacist at those other institutions that are also involved. Whether they're oncology trained or not, they're the ones that are helping manage some of these toxicities and educating their non-oncology team what a BTK inhibitor is and whether or not they think that that is the reason for the toxicity and then helping manage that toxicity. It's a lot of pharmacists, you know, all over the place, which is really great.
So it really sounds like that continuous adherence is so important to this treatment with BTK inhibitors. And it's really critical for the success of the patient, the outcomes that are intended for the disease. Can you please elaborate on the impact of non-adherence to patient outcomes?
Non-adherence, you know, to put it frankly, is bad. Patients are going to have worse outcomes if they are not adherent. And that's, you know, just the bluntness of the matter. And it's not just in my opinion. We actually have data that shows that if patients are not adherent, they're going to have worse progression-free survival. We're not going to be able to control their disease if they're not taking their medication as most effectively and consistently as possible. We have two manuscripts that I want to talk about today that are specifically for BTK inhibitors. And there are a lot of other studies out there for CML drugs and other oral chemotherapies, but specifically for BTK inhibitors and for ibrutinib. There's a study by Barr and colleagues published in Blood in 2017, and then Williams and colleagues also published in 2019. These are studies that showed that if patients are not adherent, and the way that they defined non-adherence was if you missed 7 consecutive days, which is a lot, or if they were not taking their medications more than 80% of the time, which is actually not that much, right? So that's a patient that misses more than 2 days per week. That's how they define non-adherence. If those patients were not taking their medication or missed two or more days per week, their progression-free survival was worse. Their disease was not as controlled because they were missing their medications. And one of the other interesting aspects of the study was that patients became non-adherent pretty quickly. Within 8 weeks, some patients were already non-adherent. And so that's why we have very close monitoring initially for patients to make sure that if they're having toxicities within the first 8 weeks, that we're aggressively medically managing the patients and educating them on what they can do. And also continuing to educate them on the importance of adherence, and that if they're not adherent, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to control their disease as well.
So we focused on non-adherence on so many different podcasts specific to disease states. And I think of barriers to adherence, payment issues, the element that a patient starts feeling better and they stop taking their medication. What type of barriers to adherence do you see in patients with BTK inhibitors?
Every patient is unique, and every patient's going to have their own unique situations that, you know, cause them to be not perfectly adherent, right? And so it's our job as pharmacists to try to identify what is unique about that patient. And that's, you know, going back to one of the challenges of we have to be adaptable, not only with the changing landscape of treatment, but also kind of the changing landscape of patients and, you know, what issues patients have. And so, you know, one big aspect is socioeconomic. Patients that can't afford their medication are not going to take their medications. So those are some things that we try to help out with patients. We have a very robust oral chemotherapy program that helps us try to find grants. We try to, you know, write for petitions to the pharmaceutical company to help for assistance. So we're doing quite a bit to block that barrier. Some things are, you know, the patients are just, to your point, just feeling well, right? Patient's been on, say, acalabrutinib for 2 years now and has absolutely no disease symptoms. So they're thinking, well, my disease is gone. Maybe I don't need to take this medication. Or the inverse, some patients are having toxicities and they don't feel well from their medication. And so that can be a barrier to good adherence. Some patients don't trust healthcare. You know, especially right now with COVID, there's just so much misinformation going on that the trust as a whole in healthcare is not the best. And so I think, you know, as pharmacists, it's our job to build rapport with our patients. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we have these touch points to develop relationships with these patients. And that's why our touch points are there's a lot initially where, you know, we're monitoring patients sometimes on a weekly and then a biweekly basis to, you know, not only just catch things, but also to develop the relationship with patients. Some things are patient related where, you know, think about CLL, the median age of CLL is about 70, 72. Some patients are even older. And so some patients can't remember to take their medications. And so these are some things that, you know, we can help identify and help with patients. Some patients have a big pill burden because of their disease characteristics or their comorbidities. And so, you know, we try our best to help them with that as well.
Pharmacists are so trusted by their patients. There have been so many surveys over the years that have been done, which shows a very high trust level between patients and pharmacists. I think that's important for adherence too, and understanding and education. So what do you think pharmacists can do to help a patient that is having challenges with adherence to oral medications such as BTK inhibitors?
Yeah, the first thing that I always try to do is involve my patient as much as possible. And that starts from when the diagnosis is made that, you know, myself and our physician colleagues are sitting down with a patient to discuss why we think they have their diagnosis and what their diagnosis means to them. And we're helping them and it we're educating them on their various options so that they can help decide what therapy that might be best for them. Because if they feel like they have a choice, they feel like they're a little bit more empowered, and they feel like they're helping make decisions, and that their decisions matter, right? And so when we have that mentality that their decisions matter, well, their decisions will also matter a lot with adherence. And so that's one of the big things, is trying to empower the patients so that they feel like they have some say. We try to also motivate them too. One motivation is going back to some of the studies that we talked about, that you know, you need to take this medication every single day. And the more you miss, the less likely we're going to be able to control your disease. But, you know, ultimately, we really try to encourage them to take an active role in their care. You know, the big thing about all of this is what we touched upon initially, you know, and I mentioned that I do a lot of lectures and educating to trainees and whatnot, but, you know, a lot of our day-to-day is educating patients, and they might not be didactic lectures and whatnot, but, you know, we're sitting down and we're educating them on their therapies. We're educating them on the importance of adherence. We're educating them on toxicities so that they're aware of the toxicities, so that when the toxicities happen, they're not surprised and they're not caught off guard. And they can't say, well, Anthony, you didn't tell me about this side effect. I was completely not expecting this. And then, you know, they lose trust. So developing trusting and honest relationships are really important, I think, for adherence.
So let's talk a little bit about digital technology and the use of technologies that are more prevalent now than ever, especially with the pandemic. We're doing Zoom meetings now more than ever. I think I do at a minimum two a day, if not five a day. So the use of digital technology in telemedicine has really expanded. It's grown and it's become more secure. And I'm wondering, can you share examples of digital technology solutions when it comes to treatment and in pharmacist interaction?
Sure. There's actually very recently, one of my colleagues at the University of Michigan published a study showing the use of electronic text messaging, so a digital technology, that the text message would send off to a patient that was receiving any highly immunogenic chemotherapy. And this text message would ask the patient a variety of different things, very simple things like, you know, did you drink today? Are you able to keep in food? Are you nauseous? Did you have to take any of your breakthrough medications? Things like that. And then what this technology would then do is create a scoring tool that would fire off to our pharmacist. And if it hit a certain number, it would red flag the pharmacist to say, oh, you know, Sally's not eating or drinking. She might need a call. And so our pharmacist would then call that patient after being triggered by the electronic medical record, call the patient. And actually we had a collaborative practice where they're able to prescribe antiemetics while the patient's at the home. So what this ended up doing was it reduced healthcare utilization, especially right now with COVID. Nobody wanted to leave their homes and go to the hospital or even go to their PCP. So we are able to just call in a prescription, have the patient pick up a prescription for nausea medications. Or what we also did is, you know, the medications that they had available to them at their home, you know, a lot of times we're giving ondansetron or Compazine. We were just able to teach them how to then administer breakthrough antiemetics to help with their nausea. And we were able to reduce healthcare visits. We were able to reduce ED visits. And I say we, it's not me. I don't want to take the credit for this. It was all my colleagues on our outpatient side that did this. And it was remarkable. And you know, all of the leadership, non-pharmacy leadership and in our cancer center absolutely loved this because of how much we were able to reduce healthcare utilization. So that's one big integration that we had at our institution. There are a lot of tools out there, and it really depends on what you're trying to do, right? So if a patient is not remembering to take their medication, there's this really cool service called a virtually observed therapy, where a patient can take their iPad or their iPhone and they'll video themselves taking their medication. And on the other side, there could be a third party that watches them take their medication. Obviously, this is not that easy to do when you're taking a medication every single day, and it could be somewhat laborious for that third party. So what these technologies now are starting to do is use artificial intelligence that, you know, our iPhones are pretty smart. They can look at you and say, okay, well, that's Anthony, because it has facial recognition. And then it can see the tablet that you're taking, and then you administer the medication. So this is something that I think is really cool. I think it's up and coming. The other thing that it can do is it can track things. So when you forget or to show your iPhone or your whatever digital technology that you're using, your iPad, when you forget to do it that day, it'll remind you to say, hey, you forgot to take your ibrutinib today. So there are a decent amount of examples out there. There's Emocal Mobile Health. There's Sure Adhere. And then, you know, there are other things that I think patients are using a little bit more of, and that's adherence apps. I think they're pretty easy to use. There's a lot of them out there. There's Pill Monitor, there's Care Zone. They're just widely available, and those are digital technologies that can help patients remember to take their medications. There are also smart pill bottles. And I remember smart pill bottles probably like 15 years ago or so, when there was a really cool study that was trying to monitor imatinib adherence. And they used a pill bottle that every time you pulled off the cap, there was a sensor in the cap. Patients didn't know it, and they were tracking their adherence. And so now, obviously, the patients will know that there's a sensor in the cap, but then that sensor can then track their adherence. They can track how many times patient opened their cap of their bottle. And again, if they forgot to open their cap today or their bottle today, it would then trigger them to take their medication. There are other technologies. There's smart pill dispensers that I think are pretty cool. There are smart technologies. I don't know exactly their names, but they're sort of like these mini robots that are like your digital a digital caretaker almost, where this little robot can actually see you in the room. And as you're walking by, say, hey, Anthony, it's time to take your medication. And then the little robot kind of just spits out the medication. And then you kind of have to just take the medication right then and there. So this thing acts like your caregiver almost. So a lot of really cool things that are, you know, up and coming, and some things that are already being used.
So there have been some studies done on improving patient outcomes. One of them is the BASH study. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, there's been two BASH studies. They've done an incredible job showing the benefit of digital health. So in these studies, essentially what they do is they have the patient report out. So these are patient reported outcomes on a tablet or an email or a computer. And they're essentially answering 12 questions. And when they answer these 12 questions, it then routes the answers to physicians or the nurses, and then they'll get email alerts and they'll get alerted when patients are reporting more severe or worsening symptoms. And what will then happen is it'll trigger the nurse to call the patient to, you know, triage, okay, what's going on? How can I help? Obviously, they can prescribe things at home, and they can also tell the patient to come in for medical attention if it's needed. And so because they are able to catch symptoms so much earlier, and they manage symptoms so much earlier with this digital technology, they actually reduced ED visits, they reduced hospital admissions. And what was remarkable is that patients were able to then stay on their therapy longer, because they were now, managing the toxicities. And with staying on therapy longer, that ends up equating to better disease control of their underlying malignancy. And ultimately, Bosch and colleagues showed an improvement in overall survival when they used this digital technology technology as compared to standard of care. And the other important thing beyond just improving overall survival that I think is important is improvement of quality of life. They are able to show that as well.
So can you please also share a little more on how these tools are used in everyday clinical practice for patients?
Again, it kind of goes back to, what is the unique needs of your patient? And so I think you can envision using these technologies in 1,000 different ways. And so it really comes down to your personal preference, the patient's needs, the patient's personal preference. But going back to the 4 touch points that I mentioned, so inside of the clinics, inside of the pharmacy, the patient communicating from home, or pharmacist following up with the patient at home. Those are kind of the 4 places that I guess I'll start. And so, in the clinics, the first thing that we tend to do is try to standardize digital prescribing. So that's digital, right? And this helps reduce medication errors. Even during COVID, started doing virtual educations. And some of them we could do pre-recorded because you can capture more patients. But obviously, we would prefer one-on-one, but it's a possibility to do things pre-recorded because, it's digital. And so patients can have on-demand, kind of like Netflix, where they can just watch things whenever they want, or if they need to remind themselves of certain toxicities or certain things about their medication, they have the ability to just pull it up and learn about it again. And it also makes things a little bit more interactive for patients too. Navigating access from the clinic, and this goes through the pharmacy. We have a digital portal where we can see all the communication that's kind of going back and forth so that we know where the medication is in the process. Is it stuck with requiring a prior auth? Is it stuck with needing grant support or copay assistance? Is it stuck just waiting for the patient to pick it up, right? So these are all things that we can help monitor, and obviously can then help with adherence, because if a patient doesn't have their medication with them, they can't be adherent. And as I said, in the Huff studies and the Bosch studies, there's quite a bit of integration now with the EMR with text messaging. So those are some examples inside the clinic. In the clinic, we can also help educate patients on how to set up their apps. We can help them with, pill bottles and things like that. But also the pharmacy, inside the pharmacy, can do that as well. So the pharmacy is going to help with, navigating access, as I mentioned, with the portal. They can help dispense or educate patients on using the digital pill packs or the digital bottles. I'm trying to think what else. There's just so many examples that you can turn this into a lot of different ways to help patients. When the patient goes home, I think one of the biggest things that I think is important are patient reported outcomes. So now with digital technology, it makes things just so much easier for them to not have to call, sit on hold, get to somebody that might not be the right person. With digital technologies, they can send a text message. It fires right to who it needs to fire to. So that's something for when the patient goes home. And, I mentioned video directly observed therapies or VDOT. So that's when, the patient is actually observed via their tablet or their phone, taking their medication. So that's something that patient can use at home. And then, the last touch point from the pharmacist was us calling the patient when they're at home. And one of the things that we've utilized a lot of more recently is video visits, or what we call virtual visits. And the nice thing is that insurance companies recognize the need and the importance of virtual visits. And so a lot of times we're able to bill, and we're able to bill as pharmacists for that interaction with patients. And so we've done a ton of just checkups, educations, things like that, so that we're constantly in communication with our patients when they need it.
I think of how healthcare is going through this transformation in pharmacy, very much so. Some of the roles of pharmacists are so much expanding, especially with the use of digital technology. And you touched on telemedicine and in how insurance companies now are embracing and reimbursing the use of telemedicine in pharmacy counseling and ongoing. So kind of expand upon telemedicine specifically in your practice over the last year.
Yeah, absolutely. So COVID has forced us to innovate very quickly. And again, it goes back to that big challenge that we first talked about and that pharmacists need to adapt. And honestly, we adapted very, very quickly compared to some of our colleagues. Technology is something that we embrace. I just feel like it's in pharmacist DNA to just rapidly change to whatever situation and whatever is urgently needed, right? And so COVID was one of those things that forced us to do that. So we started doing a lot of virtual visits, which, you know, patients absolutely love. We loved. We were doing, you could do virtual med recs. You can do virtual toxicity checks. You can manage their toxicities for the most part from home. And so we tried to use as much virtual visits as possible to try to prevent patients from having to come into the hospital or even to our clinic. And we did this virtually in all patients, unless they needed a physical exam or they needed to come in for tests, for other reasons. So all other patients we're doing virtual visits for. Communication, if communication was the main intervention and we didn't, patients didn't need to come in for CT scans or PET scans or whatever, we were doing them virtually. So that's a big change that we had. To me, it's much, much more efficient for my practice to just jump on a Zoom than to, find a patient in the room. Our rooms are a hot commodity. We're trying to get patients in and out. There are just not enough rooms to room patients, especially with COVID, because there's a lot of cleaning that we had to do. You're only allowed a certain amount of people in a room at once. Only allowed a certain amount of people in hallways at once. So freeing up all that traffic by pushing as much as possible at home was really great. And so I think it was definitely much more efficient for me, but I think also for the healthcare system, it was much more efficient for patients. Also, patients loved virtual visits. Our capture area is massive. Could you imagine driving 8 hours, just for a toxicity check that we could talk about it, over a virtual visit, right? So patients not having to drive hours and hours, even a patient that lives, I'm in Ann Arbor, if they live, 15 minutes from our institution, even for them, trying to find parking takes forever. So for them, they are really happy. And beyond efficiency, it really encouraged better communication back and forth from us and the patient. And with better communication, we are able to rapidly identify, prevent, and treat patients' toxicities earlier. And you saw from the studies that I mentioned earlier that if you identify, prevent, and treat a patient's toxicity earlier, they're going to stay on their therapy longer. They're going to stay adherent. Their disease is going to stay in better control, and you're likely going to improve how long they live.
This has been a fascinating conversation. So much appreciate you spending our time, spending your time with us and giving our listeners kind of an in-depth understanding of BTK inhibitors and kind of something that's much more modern, which is the technologies at hand that we can be leveraging now as pharmacists. In wrapping up, what would you say is the single most important takeaway for our pharmacists listening in?
Patients who are not adherent with their BTK inhibitors will have worse outcomes. That is the unfortunate truth. However, majority of this is preventable. And I think pharmacists being a part of their care will be able to prevent some of the non-adherence and the toxicities from the BTK inhibitors. Pharmacists are able to identify the barriers. They're able to find solutions. They're able to help medically manage some of the toxicities. They're able to educate patients and have, you know, a unique skill with patients in keeping them on therapy. So, and with that, I think we're very lucky to have a number of new digital technologies that we're able to use to make our care much more efficient. And, you know, it's not only better for managing patients, it's also better just for me as a pharmacist and other medical professionals. And ultimately, you know, today's discussion was about adherence, and there's no doubt in my mind that these digital technologies are helping promote adherence. And ultimately, when you promote adherence, patients stay on therapy longer, and they're going to derive more benefit from their therapy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Anthony. This has been fascinating. We very much appreciate you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the PTCE Pharmacy Connect podcast. Your feedback is important to us. Please share with us your thoughts on this episode and other topics you'd like to learn about. Go to pharmacytimes.org/contact and send us a message.